Welcome to Tonic Boom, a specialist capital markets podcast series brought to you by Tonic, the expertise-led consultancy dedicated to giving firms more. Join our host, our resident Tonic Ninjas, and industry experts as we drop the mic on the hot market topics across high-profile domains such as margin, post-trade, treasury, risk, digital, legal, sustainability, and more. More expertise, more trust, more achieved. Ready for your dose of Tonic?
Hello, and welcome to the inaugural Tonic Boom. I'm Chris Watts, Tonic CEO and co-founder, and I guess as of today, I'm going to try my best to be a pretty average podcast host. I will desperately try not to slip into wedding DJ mode, but I suspect that's exactly where we'll end up. Anyways, enough about me. What is Tonic Boom? So Tonic Boom's our expertise-led podcast series covering the hottest topics across capital markets and beyond. Here, you'll see us engage real industry SMEs and leaders to help us break down some of the key industry focus areas. We're going to take an informal look at some of the key trends, challenges, and solutions whilst trying to help our listeners understand the nuances involved. On to today's podcast, our Treasury Clearing Kickstarter. We have a fantastic bunch of ninjas with me today, all friends from the US, which makes sense, bearing in mind the topic. We have Travis Keltner and Jeff Saul, both from State Street. And we have Phil Cook, our resident Tonic Ninja. Chaps, do you mind giving us some brief intros? Travis, maybe starting with you.
Thanks, Chris, for having us today. And I'm really looking forward to this podcast series. My name is Travis Keltner. I am the global head of secured financing for State Street Bank. That is a global mandate that covers really largely fixed income activities, particularly repo. And, you know, near and dear to my heart is clearing. We are primarily a clearing repo institution. And so really excited to join and talk about some of these topics we're getting into today.
Thanks, Travis. And Jeff?
Yeah, thanks, Chris. I'm really looking forward to the podcast series. On point with your intro, we'll try to be a little bit better than average with our commentary. So anyway, Jeff Sowell, I work with Travis and Travis's organization. I lead product development for all of State Street's repo initiatives globally.
Great stuff. And Mr. Cook.
All right. My name is Phil Cook. I've got about 20 years in capital markets operations experience, and I'm the head of post-trade for Tonic Consultants.
Awesome. So great lineup. But before we get into the guts of treasury clearing, we do have the chance to get to know one of our guests a little better. And we're going to do this under the guise of the trusty Two Truths, One Lie Challenge. Jeff, you're our lucky guy today. Now, the clue's in the name, so I don't think I need to explain the rules. Best we just crack on and pray to God that this works out. Travis, you know Jeff incredibly well, so I don't think it's fair for you to take part in this one. So we're going to ask you politely to step aside, and Phil and I are going to step up to see if we can spot the lie. One guess each, Mr. Cook. No dirty tricks. So Jeff, the floor is yours, sir.
So before I give you my three statements, I'll acknowledge that coming up with these took far longer than I care to admit. So I'm not going to tell you how long it took. But with that said, I'll get right into it. So the first statement is, my wife and I just bought our first house. Second statement, and this is a hot take, whether it's a truth or a lie, is that I hate cheese. Third statement, my first job that paved the way to my illustrious career thus far at State Street was at a fruit and veggie stand.
Wow. Okay. So can we repeat back? Can we validate? It was first house, it was hates cheese, and it was fruit and veg first job.
That's it.
Mr. Cook, fancy leading?
Well, I know you were living on a boat. I didn't know if you were buying a new house. I'm going to go with the house.
Yeah, I wondered. Yeah, we do know that about Jeff. Would Jeff leave the boat? That's the key question, isn't it? I thought you loved the boat.
See, this is why I planted it. Now I'm making you think.
Podcast topic, Jeff living on a boat.
You guys have no idea. So I've been living on a boat for 8 years now. Travis has been hearing this for the last 8 years. Like, we joke that every time I mention this during a client meeting, Travis can, like, you know, go to sleep for a couple of minutes while I pontificate about what it's like to live on a boat. So Travis has heard this before ad nauseum.
I got it. Yeah, look, I might have to side with Phil here because I thought you were perfectly happy on the boat. You've got an awesome life with Mrs. Jeff. I can believe the fruit and veg, the humble start. We've all got one of those. And the hating cheese, yeah, I think that's That doesn't sound too crazy to me. Lego, is that two votes for the boat? Have you got us?
No, you guys got me. You nailed it. I tried to give you a little bit of a trick, but you guys saw right through it.
Awesome. We'll take that. 1-0 Tonic.
1-0.
Jeff, thank you. That was great. So we should probably move on to the Kickstarter. And safe to say that Treasury Clearing is one of those monster initiatives that's going to affect all players across capital markets and beyond, some shape or form. But it's a big topic, super big. So we're not going to try and cover it all today. Today, we're going to focus mainly on the foundations of Treasury Clearing. And then we're going to use some of our later podcasts to zoom in on those key focus areas. So I guess my job is really just to do a bit of upfront scene setting before I pass across to our ninjas. Market size wise, it's worth mentioning this one. So US Treasury market today has open balances of some $27 trillion. So that's a number that I struggle even to understand. I did a little bit of research overnight, and that $27 trillion is roughly the same size as the next seven biggest government bond markets combined. So scale, crazy scale. In terms of the percentage of treasuries cleared today, slight differential between cash and repo. So for cash trades, is something like 13% of trades are fully cleared today. But when you take into account the hybrid trades, so those that are cleared by one party, you get just over 30%, 3-0. On the repo side, it's between about 30 to 40% of the market that's cleared today. So I guess in summary, Treasury Clearing mandate is a really big deal with a huge amount of work coming in between now and the reg compliance dates. So speaking of regulations, this feels like the right time to pass across to you guys to gain some insights on, I guess, the background and the rules. Maybe we start with market drivers here. Phil, are you okay to summarize some of those for us?
Yeah. In general, the intention of these rules are to increase stability, reduce risk, and generate resiliency in the U.S. Treasury market. The market has grown. It's gotten six times larger now than it was before the 2008-2009 crisis and has seen a 743% increase since the year 2000. It's critical for the world economy to function efficiently, and it's grown immensely over the last 25 years. With that, there's a few disruption events that were noted when generating these rules. There was an October 2014 flash rally. The 10-year Treasury dropped and rebounded 37 basis points in a day. This was unusual in historic trade volatility or price volatility and was unattributed to any particular event. There was also a September 2019 repo market disruption. Interest rates on September 17 for repo went from 2.43 to 5.25%. And hit a peak during the day of 10%, which is huge. There was also the COVID shock in March 2020, which is also known as the dash for cash. S&P dropped 12% on a given day. There was a rush to safety in dollars and treasuries, causing a liquidity squeeze in the market. With some of these disruption events, the central clearing rules are getting put in place to increase liquidity and ensure stability when the markets are stressed. When the trades are centrally cleared, the central counterparty steps in between the two trading parties and becomes a counterparty to each side, and this guarantees the settlement. This makes the market stronger and provides guarantee that you'll get good cash or security on your trade. They mentioned that the approach here that the SEC has taken is consistent with the clearing mandates that went into place after the 2008-2009 crisis. You know, the derivatives moved to central clearing. So similarly to that, the SEC is moving U.S. Treasury trades to central clearing.
And Phil, I think to take a step back, a lot of times the repo and funding markets end up taking a backseat to some of the sexier like FX and currency and other markets, emerging markets, stuff like that. The fact of the matter is when there's a market stress event, you need liquidity, you need funding, you need those markets to function properly. They underpin the entire financial system. So all of those different stress events you mentioned, it's really critical that folks have access to raise cash when they need it, whether it's to meet margin calls, to meet other obligations, swap out into more conservative asset types and things like that. So again, I think the fixation from the SEC's perspective is really trying to solve around the data transparency, the functioning of the repo market, just in the context of that role of the cornerstone of the rest of the financial markets.
Yeah, it could be another asset class that's in trouble, but the treasury market is critical in order to support what's needed for that asset class, right?
Good stuff. Thanks, chaps. Strong sort of intro to Treasury Clearing and some helpful steps and history there. Phil, do you maybe want to talk us through just for someone that's not been exposed to US Treasury clearing at all, what some of those key rules might look like in terms of scope and maybe the dates that we're talking about here?
Yep, absolutely. So there's two types of transactions that are involved in these rules. So there's cash transactions, which are normal buys and sells. So these are going to need to be centrally cleared if they're traded between brokers, dealers, and major banks. This is dealer-to-dealer trading, so generally the sell side. The rules do not mandate central clearing for the cash trades between dealers and the buy side. So this requirement comes into play on December 31st, 2025. The other transaction type this affects are the repo transactions that we've mentioned, or repurchase agreements. These inclusion rules are different. So the dealer-to-dealer trades need to be centrally cleared, but also the trades between dealers and customers will need to be centrally cleared. So this will pull in a large majority of the repo transactions and will force the buy side to centrally clear. These requirements go into effect on June 30, 2026. I did want to note, as we have this discussion and go into future discussions and have the additional podcasts, we will mainly be talking about the central clearing for repo. Dealers and banks have been centrally clearing for quite some time. This isn't that new to them. There will be an increase in the volume, but this will be new for many of the buy side firms. This includes investment managers, hedge funds, insurance companies, pension funds, corporations, et cetera.
Very good. Thank you, sir. So we've talked about, I guess, some of the drivers. We've given an overview, I guess, of the high level scope and dates. Have we introduced the current central counterparty, conscious that as of today, there's only one show in town, although we know that's evolving. Phil, do you maybe we want to just close that one out?
Sure. So there's only one CCA, or covered clearing agency. We'll also use the word CCP when we discuss, and that's FICC-GSD. That's the Fixed Income Clearing Corporation, Government Securities Division. It's part of the larger organization, DTCC, and was officially formed in 2003. It wasn't necessarily brand new at that time. That was just the formation date. It did come from prior organizations under DTCC, the Government Securities Clearing Corporation, also the Mortgage-Backed Securities Clearing Corporation. And as you mentioned, you know, they are the only game in town right now, but we have seen announcements from CME, and we do know that other central counterparties are interested in getting into the space.
Good stuff.
I would just like to add, I think it's, you know, and we'll get into some of the history of clearing in a second. I think, Chris, I think that's what you're going to tee me up for. But, you know, to kind of introduce a new CCP in a matter of 1.5 to 2 years, greater than just over 2 years, is, you know, given the history and the evolution and the iteration it takes to kind of get to the right place, is a major upbringing. And so I think, you know, I think it's the introduction of new CCPs to address this could have a benefit, but there's also, you know, it's not an easy task, and there's a big build required regardless if you're a current CCP or clear of other activities. So something we want to, you know, listeners might want to think about if they're waiting or watching, but, you know, better for the market perhaps, but also will take some time ahead of the compliance date.
Good point, well made. And I think we'll probably zoom in on that one a little bit more as time goes on. But yes, no, Travis, you're absolutely right. And that's quite a nice segue, I think, to maybe the broader potted history of repo clearing over the years. Do you mind seeing if you can give us a whistle-stop tour, including maybe some of the key players involved?
Yeah, I'll give it my best. You asked me what I love, and maybe this plays into our two truths at some point. But, you know, I enjoy long walks on the beach. I like gardening, and I love the rich history of central clearing counterparties, you know, but all jokes aside, I do think that it's really important to understand there is a richness to it, and there's a really interesting history. And maybe I'll just touch on a couple of the high level points through it. And, you know, Phil started to get there, but this really goes back to the 1980s, where government securities were really an unregulated market for all forms of trading. And the primary dealers worked to kind of introduce effectively the GSCC in 1986, identifying the benefits of between the primary dealer community to kind of access each other efficiently, to benefit from matching comparison, operational efficiencies, and also, you know, risk efficiencies and management around that, to the points of what, you know, CCP is today and evolved to the broader market. But that really got accelerated in the early 90s, really on the back of the Salomon Brothers scandal, believe it or not, where there was, you know, some level of fraud, and we've seen the Buffett speech and the U.S., you know, fraudulent UST pricing bids. And, you know, that kind of paved the way for, one, you know, really an expansion beyond the primary dealers into the broader dealer market. So those non-primaries which is a broad swath of liquidity, kind of came into it through the interdealer brokers. And on top of that, it accelerated the case for repo netting and repo clearing, which kind of launched in the mid-1990s to kind of complement the cash trading activities that the primary dealers had kind of started with. And by 94, right, there was $1 billion in systemic netting benefits just from operational netting through this, that you can see how that level of scale and efficiencies kind of play into the broader market context. You know, we saw the kind of the consolidation of different entities, GSCC, you know, we had eventually NSCC, we get these other DTC under the DTCC in 1999. And then you saw an expansion of repo clearing activities around the general collateral financing services right around then, where Bank of New York and JP Morgan, you know, tri-party agents really kind of accelerated more liquidity pools and additional asset classes like agency mortgages that only continued to broaden the pool of clear kind of dealer to dealer FICC netting member or just netting member kind of to netting member activities. A netting member, by the way, is kind of a direct member in kind of today's terms as we talk about the clearing mandate. You know, 9/11 was a huge kind of win for DTCC. It was a terrible, obviously, you know, the event, but the markets pursued, they carried on, they reopened quickly. And part of that was because DTCC was able to clear over 1.8 trillion in securities transactions during that week to keep the lights on, to keep things moving along so that the markets could reopen. A great point for the success of clearing through some of these most tragic, you know, terrible events. I think it was highlighted that, you know, FICC was established in 2003, kind of the government securities dealer merging with the GSCC kind of under that. And then in 2005, you know, not a beat of the chest, but State Street worked with FICC to introduce a new participant, the buy side, through a sponsored clearing model where the sponsored service, someone like a State Street as a sponsor with access to the market, a sponsored provider, could bring in a sponsored member to effectively access the depth of market liquidity through repo trading. Big point in the career.
I was just going to say on that one, and you don't have to answer this, but how close to 2005 was your entry to the team at State Street?
Chris, did you read my mind?
Oh, have I ruined it?
2007.
All right, lesson learned. I told you I was an average host.
Yeah, well, I wasn't going to give my age, but here we are, right? So I started in 2007, right in the midst of that. And, you know, it was a beautiful time to start on the back of the 2008 crisis where, you know, DTCC kind of, you know, successfully had another big success for clearing $500 billion of open trading of treasuries, agencies, equities. They were actually the wind down on the back of the Lehman event without one, you know, one member taking a loss. I think that's an incredible feat and recognition of the benefits for clearing really when these stresses take place. So then clearing kind of, you know, on the back of the 08, we had a lot of reg reform. We had capital liquidity leverage, you know, balance sheet requirements that were really meant to strengthen our bank's resiliency on the back of these events. And clearing became more of a balance sheet opportunity where benefits from netting, from lower counterparty risk exposures, really kind of became the selling point of clearing and, you know, in exchange for levels of margin and risk management. But really how this has kind of taken its shape. And, you know, we really think it's really opened up the door kind of to, you know, even like custodians like ourselves when in 2017 FICC expanded to really bring in the buy side as that participant through a major expansion through the sponsored service to allow for two-sided trading, a broader set of jurisdictions that they slowly work towards. You know, we saw the end users on the other side, the alternatives and the leverage community come in, and it's really scaled to, you know, that $1 trillion, those 200, you know, 35 sponsors on the back of the 200 kind of government securities dealer accounts. And, you know, if you think about this, I like to think about as an analogy, and we'll keep the nautical theme, right? You think about a boat trying to cross the ocean by itself. You think of that as a repo counterparty trying to, you know, manage its own risk, trade in a market, a vast market of liquidity. And really over the years, what we've seen is this development of an armada where you've seen multiple boats now together, right? And they've started, they can see kind of what's going on, but there is also, you know, you don't know what's happening inside the boat or the ship, and they're of different sizes. And now you've started to introduce tugboats and coast guards kind of around that to kind of support that. So when someone goes under, they pull someone out and the boat, the armada continues, right? And so we've seen this grown and grow, and now you got the buy side boats joining. You've got a really broad community, and now it's obligatory, right? And that's what we're going to get to. And it's going to have an interesting dynamic, but that armada is just going to grow bigger and bigger there's trade-offs, there's protections. It gets back to resiliency, transparency, and the concept of liquidity that we'll obviously, I'm sure we'll get into further.
I'm going to be borrowing that analogy, by the way. Thank you.
That was awesome.
Take it. It's free.
I think you've got a book in you, Travis.
Yeah.
I might have to start calling you Professor Keltner. That was awesome. I didn't expect that. That was a great level of detail over how this has played out over the last 20 years and how we've got to today, I guess. So thank you, sir. So we should probably move on a little bit to some of the practical implications of what treasury clearing brings for in-scope firms, some of those key impact areas that firms can expect to see on the other side, particularly for those buy-side players that maybe don't clear today. Jeff, chance to redeem yourself after the two truths, one lie challenge. Do you want to maybe take us through, just at a high level, some of those key impact areas?
Yeah, of course. So I think maybe before I get into the impact areas, I'll kind of pick off from where Professor Keltner left us off in 2017. And 2017 was really when the sponsored product, as we know it, was launched and broadened. And prior to that, in the interim period between 2005 and 2017, it was really more of a niche, very limited scope product. And what we saw as soon as FIC expanded its rules was all of a sudden, more and more boats, to Travis's analogy, started to get involved and participate. And State Street lost its honor as the only sponsor participating. And now today there's over 35 sponsors. So I think the growth story of the sponsored market is best evidenced by how it rebounded after kind of the COVID bottoming out and in the zero rate environment. So whereas the sponsored market initially was a landing spot for 2a7 money fund cash investment, what we saw post-COVID was really this blossoming of, as soon as all of that 2a7 cash came out of the market and was just being thrown at the Fed's RRP facility because those funds were eligible, volumes continued to grow and more firms continued to get involved. So now you're talking about firms from upwards of 47 jurisdictions, including all 27 of the EU member states. You're talking about firms looking to invest cash on a collateralized basis, like money funds, pensions, corporates, insurance companies. But then on the other side of the trade, you've got alt funds, you've got REITs, you've got a really diverse mix of participants in this program. So to me, I think that's where the sponsor model growth story really evidenced itself was, this is no longer a niche product. This is now a product in and of itself. So, if you look at where we are today, this is now an ultra competitive model. It's fully ubiquitous in the marketplace. Everyone knows about it. Cat's out of the bag type of thing. I mean, this is mature. Mm-hmm. This is a mature model. The one thing I'll say is FIC has a number of different access models for the buy side. We've talked a lot about the sponsored model, the most ubiquitous, the most adopted model. There are other models, including a more agented model where, and we'll get into this, I think subsequently, we want to do some deep dives on access models in additional podcasts. But the point is, this sponsor model was really the only one or the one that was adopted. So specifically, just to get into the minutiae on this. So FIC GSE's rulebook is the governing document for this program. So this rulebook is online. It's 325 pages, super fun to read. Highly recommend it if you're trying to go to sleep or something. I'm kidding. So that rule book, as the governing document, kind of defines all foundational concepts for how the clearing program works. So the sponsored clients are, or the sponsored members are, as the name suggests, members of the CCP, albeit in a limited capacity, right? So you have netting members, they're full-fledged members. I guess the obvious question is, why doesn't everyone just decide they want to be a netting member? Isn't that the simplest? Well, there's eligibility requirements that many buy sides won't meet, not to mention it's costly, takes a lot of time, and there's ongoing maintenance requirements in order to keep that standing as well. So It isn't really a great fit, which is why the sponsored model tends to work. Now, whether you're a netting member or a sponsored member, you're still getting all of the benefits of what FIC GSD, as the CCP in this case, has to offer. Like any other CCP, I'll just boil it down to three basic elements. So one is the concept of novation. So trades novate at FIC upon comparison. So when we talk about novation, we're talking about the original delivery, receipt, and related payment obligations that might be entered into bilaterally are terminated and broken into effectively two halves with FIC sitting in the middle of it. So now FIC is installed into the transaction right in the middle to manage the risk. As part of that risk management, there's also an operational netting component too, right? So just like any other CCP, FIC is netting different transactions between counterparts in order to minimize flows back and forth and simplify settlement. The third piece, risk management. So all netting members contribute to FIC's clearing fund, which is part of their loss mutualization waterfall. So FIC uses a VAR-based methodology. So considerations for that would be overall volume traded, characteristics of net securities positions, transaction tenors, et cetera. So those three concepts, novation, netting, risk management, are kind of the package, I think, of what FIC is offering in this space and why the model really works.
That was great. Well, that was good fun. Thank you, gents. Super insightful from all of you. Some hugely valuable contributions there. And a lot learned, I think, certainly for me, and I don't doubt for our listeners as well. It's not an easy one to wrap up because this is, as we've said numerous times, a big, big topic, but it's clear that Treasury clearing is going to force major transformation across the market in coming years. We want to stay on top of some of the focus areas that we talked about today and peel them back and go down another level. And within our subsequent Tonic Boom series, you will see us discuss topics such as access model selection, such as the cost and liquidity impacts of Treasury clearing, likewise collateral, the brand new operating model that firms are going to have to consider, and of course some of the more practical guidance such as how to start a Treasury clearing program, how to mobilize quickly, bearing in mind these end dates that are in sight. Well, that's a wrap. The inaugural Tonic podcast done. Thank you so much to all of the guys involved. We will see you next time.
You've been listening to Tonic Boom. Don't forget to like and subscribe to stay up to date on the latest developments and industry opinion across capital markets. Visit thetonicconsultancy.com to see more of our expertise-led insights and end-to-end solutions. Tonic. More expertise, more trust, more achieved.